This is the fourth day of this June 2018 seven-day session. And we'll leave behind now the teachings of Chinese Zen Master Daikaku and go to another text, a book called Zen Essence. It's another anthology. We're going from one anthology to another one. And this, too, is translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. We're going to pick up here. It's a collection of various Chinese masters, the great Chinese masters. And we'll pick up where we left off, I don't know, about 2 years ago, with the short, little bite-sized teachings of Chinese Zen Master Foyan. His dates are 1067 to 1120, which puts him about a generation before yesterday's Daikaku. Starts by saying, I tell people to get to know themselves. Some people think this means what beginners observe and consider it easy to understand. Reflect more carefully in a more probing manner. What do you call yourself? I think what he means when he says, some people think this means what beginners observe. That is what we come to learn about ourselves over the years, about the way we habitually act and react to people, the way we think, our patterns of thinking and reacting, our habits, our strengths and weaknesses. Okay, fair enough, that's part of our self, an aspect of it. But he says, wait, reflect more carefully in a more probing manner. What do you call yourself? We find when we do look more closely that there's no fixed entity here, unchanging, that it's what we call the self is very much depends on context and circumstances and relations. Our what we call the self is relationally determined. We talk and act and respond in certain ways with certain people and other ways with other people. We're subject to changing conditions. There is no fixed person. Yes, there are tendencies. There are certain ways that we do habitually act and react, but they're just sort of broad stroke sketches of who we are. At any given time and place, we can be quite different. So what is it, he's inviting us to ask, what is it that is beyond all of these conditions and relationships? What is there that is beyond that? Is there some essence? Is there an essential self? Well, that is a phrase we use, our true self, our essential nature. But what does that mean? Who is it that hears the rain? No, really, who is it? Right now, who is it who hears the rain? Hears the warbling of the birds. Hears the train. Here's another nugget. He says, Buddhism is an easily understood teaching that saves energy, but people cause themselves pains. The ancients saw people helpless and told them to try meditating quietly. This was good advice, but later people didn't understand what the ancients meant and closed their eyes, suppressed body and mind, and sat like lumps waiting for enlightenment. How foolish. This reference but to the Dharma as saving energy, we talked about this a day or two ago in Taisho, and I found a little bit more about it here in the afterward. He stressed this Foyan, stressed the importance of what he called saving energy, effortlessly preserving the integrity of the original mind. So that means not getting snarled up in our thoughts. And that saves energy, even as it mobilizes energy. And then this warning about people who just close their eyes and sat like lumps waiting for enlightenment. This is a difference between Zen meditation and some other kinds of meditation, where they do close their eyes. We don't. Zen, we don't want to seal ourselves off from the world around us, but learn to harmonize with the world around us without getting caught by it. And so, yes, the eyes are open, but still lowered, so we're not being too involved in visual distractions. This phrase, sitting like lumps waiting for enlightenment, is one of the reasons why we still offer the stick, the kyosaku, to help people not slip into dull states. Because it's surely a timeless danger with meditation of every tradition is becoming drowsy or dull, slipping into sleep-like states without even knowing it. I have a note here in the margin, the word sunning, and I'm remembering that it's this is from, I read from this at a session in Mexico, where some of the participants there would go out in the mid-morning, during the mid-morning break before the round of sitting that precedes Taisho, and just lie sprawled in the sun, in the grass, innocent enough, we might say, but what is that? What are you doing when you're just lying there with your eyes closed? Certainly enjoying yourself, but also inviting all kinds of subjective states of visions and fantasies and daydreams, especially if you're sprawled, which means we're likely to be more, our mind is likely to be more scattered. Here's another one. Foyan said, some senior Zen practitioners say they don't rationalize at all. They don't calculate and compare at all. They don't cling to sound and form. They don't rest on defilement and purity. They say the sacred and the profane, delusion and enlightenment, are all a single clear emptiness. They say there are no such things in the midst of great light. They are veiled by the light of wisdom, fixated on wisdom. They are incurable. You'd have to be awfully advanced in your practice to be able to say these things and have it to be true. And then if it were true, you wouldn't be saying them. You wouldn't be boasting about these things. So when people say these kinds of things, when they, someone comes to me and says, I'm thinking now about brand new people who come after a workshop and they say they have no thoughts, they're just in a clear state, or sometimes they even use the word samadhi. Well, I know then that they are not, they're out of touch with what's going on in their minds. If they come and with a look of horror and say, I can't believe how cluttered my mind is, I can't get a hold of it, it's, the thoughts are just endless, then okay, now we got someone we can work with. Reminds me of a little anecdote, some book or other, where a master asked a student, are you afraid of death? And the student said, no, I'm not. And the teacher said, well, in that case, there's not much of a future for you, because the fear of death is the richest kind of ground from which to practice. Certainly the denial of death, the denial of the fear of death, is pretty universal. Another one here. When you sit meditating and enter into absorption, you should have no concerns or problems in yourself. Try to think independently, all by yourself. Other people don't know what you're doing all the time. You reflect on yourself and see whether what you are doing accords with truth or not. Here you cannot fool yourself. It's a little bit ambiguous here. This word independently is one that we see quite a bit in Foyan's teaching. try to think independently all by yourself. Well, we could suppose that he means not comparing yourself to others. It's one of the worst kinds of hindrances in Zen practice, comparing your practice to other people's practice, or what you think other people's practice is, or what you think your own practice is, comparing what you think other people's practice is, not imitating others. Other people don't know what you're doing all the time. Another way to understand this is we should maintain our practice from our own position and not to impress or please other people. So to make our private behavior mesh with our public behavior. That's a big thing. Dogen talks about that too, about comporting ourselves in private when we're alone, just as we would in public, with no concern about impressing others. It's a tall order. For example, doing the Roksu ritual in the morning. We do that together in Sesshin. We do it at sittings at Arnold Park. But for people who live at home, or house, or apartment, to do it there too. Another word for this, thinking independently, is really to have integrity. A monk once asked Joshu, "What is the principal concern of the one wearing Buddhist robes?" And Zhao Zhou said, "Not to deceive himself." So many ways we can deceive ourselves, play games with ourselves. So many ways we pose, or we aren't even aware of the ways that we're deceiving ourselves. Foyan says, he addresses here the sort of the conundrum of seeking without seeking. He says, if you seek, how is that different from pursuing sound and form? If you don't seek, how are you different from earth, wood, or stone? You must seek without seeking. Yeah, this is a very elusive matter, seeking or striving. What we want to avoid is grasping at something that we think is out there to get for ourselves. That's the real danger, in terms of spiritually speaking. And that's where he says, if you're grasping for awakening, how is that different from grasping at anything else? It's still this dualistic grasping at anything that we crave, any craving. But if we're not seeking if we're not aspiring to reach beyond ourselves, then he says, how are you different from inanimate things, earth, wood, or stone? So what happens is we refine this kind of a dilemma, seeking without seeking. This happens on its own. We don't do it. It happens on its own over time through long practice, where we find our way into this refined kind of seeking, let's say, but without grasping. I think for most of us it takes a while. Skipping a lot of these little things, they don't seem that good for reading aloud. Here's what the translator cleverly calls a doze of Zen. Nowadays, there are people who just sit there as they are. At first, they are alert, but after a while, they get sleepy. 9 out of 10 sit there dozing. If you don't know how to work, how can you sit there stubbornly expecting to understand? Okay, this is nothing we all don't already know, and yet it is such a common pitfall in Zen practice, is, you know, putting in the time, but really only being half there, just punching the clock and calling it a day. It's just a never-ending challenge is when we're sitting to really be alert and engaged and not in this sort of gray nether world of thoughts and fantasies and daydreams. It's very difficult. There too the stick can be a big help to keep us more alert. Here's another short one. Usually it is said that there is true Buddhism and then there are imitations and remnants. I say that Buddhism does not have true imitation and remnant versions. Buddhism is always in the world. If you get the point, it is true. If you miss the point, it is an imitation or a remnant. I think this is one of these cases where the word Dharma seems better to use. The Dharma means the way or the truth or the law. Buddhism, just by having an ism in it, is somehow off-putting. It can be off-putting, Buddhism. But if we substitute Dharma, the law, the way, usually it is said that there is the true way and then there are imitation and remnants. I say that the way, the law, does not have true imitation and remnant versions. The law is always in the world. If you get it, it's true. If you miss the point, it is imitation or remnant. It's just what we call the Dharma, as certainly at its simplest, is just a description of the way things are. For example, impermanence. That's one of the three characteristics of the Dharma. Impermanence. Everything is impermanent. Who is going to argue otherwise? And a second one is suffering. Pain and suffering. Who is going to argue otherwise? And the third, you could get an argument. It's not no self. The fact of no fixed permanent self. And this flies in the face of our conditioning as Westerners, especially as Americans, to say that there's no self will get you into a lot of arguments. But again, going back to the first entry we read from today, who is this self? What is this self? Is it anything more than changing causes and conditions that have acquired a certain appearance that we call me, I? Next one, you must know how to check yourself before you can attain Zen. It is because of confused minds that people strive on the way. They go to mountains and forests to see teachers on the false assumption that there is a particular path that can give people peace and comfort. They do not know it's best to work on finding out where they got confused. So not being attached to place. Of course, there are people who have this idea that if only they could go to such and such a place, or, well, if not the forests and the mountains or the desert, if only they could go to Japan or China. What Foyan is saying is look into the source of the problem. This is the work. Find out where you got confused. Introspection. The next chapter in this anthology is teachings of Zen Master Da Wei, who is pretty much a contemporary of Foyan. We're just reading from his dates are 11th to 12th centuries, and just a little bit in the afterword about Da Wei. He ranks up there in terms of the Linji lineage, or the Rinzai lineage. He ranks up there as one of the most outstanding of the masters. Sometimes known in China, was known in China as one of the three incomparables. He was sometimes described as a reincarnation of Linji. Linji, Da Wei, and Hakuin are often talked about in the same breath. He begins, the Flower Ornaments Sutra says, if you want to know the realm of the enlightened, you should make your mind as clear as space. Detach from subjective imaginings and from all grasping, making your mind unimpeded wherever it turns. That's the sutra. And then he says, the realm of the enlightened is not an external realm with manifest characteristics. Buddhahood is the realm of the eternal wisdom found in oneself. So this is obvious to those of us here in 21st century Zen Center, but there were so many uneducated monks in the time of Dawei, and in fact most of Buddhist history. So they may have taken literally the idea of a Pure Land, for example. There's the Pure Land school of Buddhism, that if you want to find your way to the Western paradise after you die. So he's just saying what we surely all know. It's not an external, enlightenment is not an external realm. It's in one's own nature. Zen Master Dogen said, the Dharma is abundantly inherent in each individual. Yet without practice, it will not be manifested, and without enlightenment, it will not be perceived. Dawei continues, you do not need paraphernalia, practices, or realizations to attain it. What you need to do is to clean out the influences of the psychological afflictions connected with the external world that have been accumulating in your psyche since beginningless time. That's a great summing up of the work we do here. What you need to do is clean out the influences of the psychological afflictions connected with the external world that have been accumulating in your psyche since beginningless time. I often think of Sesshin as kind of an excavation process. There's a phrase I just learned about recently. It originated in Sweden. It's a translation of a Swedish called death cleaning, which really means as we reach more advanced age, of recognizing that we don't want to leave others with all of our accumulated stuff, and how we can start the process of simplifying before we're disabled or sick. Cleaning out, deep cleaning. So we're doing this week, deep cleaning. Not just running the dust rag over the surface, but really getting in there. Another phrase that I think captures this work, and this is by a Soto Zen teacher by the name of Menzan. I don't know what vintage he is. But he used the phrase, melting the frozen block of emotion thought. I like that linking emotion and thought. A couple of days ago, I was interpreting Daikaku's use of the word big thoughts and little thoughts. And I was doing it pretty narrowly in terms of thoughts and concepts and ideas. And then he himself spelled it out and included more this, the realm of emotions, how we get stuck in our delusive emotional reactions to people and things. And so really emotion thought is a good linkage there. There's the emotional response, which we don't often have much to say about. It's just an immediate reaction, emotional action or feeling. That sort of comes on its own. But then we bind ourselves to it through thoughts. We have the feeling, the reaction, and then what really is the problem is dwelling on it, rewinding what happened in that situation and having all kinds of thoughts about how we could have done it differently or what we might do in the future. This is where we get so gummed up. Another one by Dawei. He quotes a Chinese folk saying, "Don't draw another's bow, don't ride another's horse, don't mind another's business." And then he says, although this is a common saying, it can also help you penetrate Zen. Just examine yourself constantly, from morning to night. What have you done that is beneficial to others and to yourself? If you notice any partiality, you should alert yourself and not overlook it. Well, here too, this is a very, very tall assignment, is to be mindful, so mindful in our daily lives that we notice when our actions or reactions are based on self-centeredness, what has also been translated as self-partiality, self-concern. Well, the truth is, almost all of it is. As long as we believe in this self, then we are inclined to want to preserve it and defend it and advance it and assert it. And if that comes just spontaneously, at least let's notice it when it's happening, so we don't deceive ourselves, as Zhao Zhou put it, not to deceive oneself. So much of what motivates our behavior is unconscious to us. We may think that we're doing something because of our goodness, the purity of our aspiration, but look again. Look hard and see what part the self is playing. But on the other hand, who's going to wait until we're completely purified of all traces of self-centeredness before acting? It's like it's just like aspiration, the basic aspiration in Zen practice. So long as we're sitting, more dramatic, we're sitting all night in yaza, extra sitting, and sure, there's part of us that we want to get something from it. Get, there's that word, get. We want to get something for ourselves. We want to get awakened. We want to get enlightenment. Okay, so it's not the purest motive for sitting, but still, why should we wait until — that would be a worse kind of mistake — wait until we're, you know, as pure as the driven snow before we do these things. So we sit, recognizing there's an element of grasping, an element of self-aggrandizement maybe, or even impressing other people who might see us sitting. Okay, sit anyway. Just don't deceive yourself. Because the wonderful thing is, the sitting, as impure as it may be, the sitting will purify those remnants of self-centeredness. The sitting is self-correcting. The sitting refines our aspiration until it becomes more about others, finding a way to see through this world of self and other in order to better be able to help people. Well, let's stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.